Give thanks to three Thanksgiving and misery of God, as you can see. But I think we have to get on, and we can't take this so much into consideration. Nevertheless, I think, as there are so few of you here at this moment, I will just begin today, before I go on, to ask you any questions. We haven't had a question and answer session with me for a month or over a month. So if you have any questions, I think in such a relatively small framework, it might work a little better, or you might have some questions. So actually, I think I should stop and ask, especially as we're now getting into the post-war world, for a little bit.
And fascist Italy, we've got futurists, and then they bring on the Roman style. How did they bring on the Roman style?
Well, we've come to fascism.
Okay.
Yeah. No, no, we've come to that. Let's just ask questions if you have them up to 1918 or up to what we've done.
You said the liberals in Germany were going back to France for guidance.
Yes.
This is the last time.
Yeah.
Would you say that about Kautsky too?
No.
He wasn't looking back to any kind of
question. What I tried to make clear last time is that after 1918, in this volatile situation, the German liberals thought with some justice that they didn't have a strong enough liberal tradition to look back upon. In a sense, they looked back upon 1848. They always looked back upon 1848. You know that the Weimar Republic adopted the flag or the colors of 1848, black, red, and gold. Those are the colors of the revolution of 1848. Yeah? So obviously they were 48ers, this is true. But beyond that, they had a great admiration for France because of the French Revolution, to which, in a way, you see, they traced their origins. But also, I think, because France overcame the Dreyfus Affair. The Third Republic had survived the challenge by the right and the left rather well in 1918, and that is, in a way, the challenge they now confront. Moreover, among the German educated classes, and this is something perhaps you must never forget, Dana, since the 18th century, French culture had a great attraction. In the better homes in Germany, you spoke French. I learned my French entirely because my parents at the dinner table, when they talked something I wasn't supposed to know, they talked in French, not Mandarin. So, you see, France, French culture, France, that was the thing. Now, they translated it into the Enlightenment, I mean, to maintain the Enlightenment, to maintain the Enlightenment, to maintain the ideas of the Enlightenment. All of this was of vast importance. And so you have Heinrich Mann writing about Zola, yes, in the First World War, and his brother attacking him as unpatriotic and so forth. Yeah? But after 1918, I think it went further even than the dictatorship of reason, for which Heinrich Mann called. And when Heinrich Mann called for the dictatorship of reason, he certainly had the French Enlightenment in view. He certainly had France. And there is no doubt that it went further. The founding of the Democratic Party in 1918 was modeled on the French radical socialists, there's very little doubt. And the big German so-called democratic press, that is press that was neither to the left nor right, you understand, liberal press, yeah? The status press always looked to France as a model.
Well, how did the social democratic tradition fit into that? What I mean is
Well, the social democrats sort of didn't have to go to that tradition, but some did and some didn't. In other words, reason within the socialist movement didn't have to go like that, because reason is built into Marxism, because Marxism is the is an Enlightenment doctrine. I mean, it grew from Enlightenment. So to the Social Democrats, reason was transmitted over socialism, yes? But the liberals had no such transmission there, yes? And as the Social Democratic Party, and I think I should say this now, I should say that later, in reality, occupied the place of liberalism in Germany. It was too bad that so few people realized it. German history might have been different if the liberals had realized that they were more or less done for, and that the space, the political space they occupied, was now occupied by the Social Democrats with their gradualism. But they didn't realize it, Mr. Daimler, because the Social Democrats kept their rhetoric. And people are apt to judge things, as you well know, by rhetoric rather than substance. So that the liberals thought the Social Democrats, they knew they supported the Weimar Republic. They knew the Weimar Republic was built on the Social Democrats. But still they had a class rhetoric which frightened all the liberals. I may have told you that before as an example. When my sister, who's considerably older than myself, first voted Social Democrat, and I was a kid, yeah? The biggest scene in my house, my mother accused her of getting an illegitimate child. That since then, illegitimate children and social democracy are sort of, in my mind, the same, yeah? But you see, in spite of the fact that, of course, there wasn't a very great difference between my parents and the Social Democrats anymore. You see what I mean? So, but they didn't realize, yes? No, because Social Democrats kept their class rhetoric. That was confusing. After all, they also competed with the communists in the workers' colonies. And that was confusing, yeah? Yes? In a sense, the liberals like these, my family, was much more interested in Russia and Lenin, you know. I remember once coming downstairs as a child and seeing a man in black ties, if you still know what that is, yeah? You know, tails and ties. And he was introduced to me as Chicherin, who was then the foreign commissar of the Soviet Republic. And I said to said that I'd never seen, you know, a Bolshevik in evening dress. But it was much more popular with Russia, because in Russia there were political and trade considerations which were far away. But the Social Democrats, yes, you had a question.
I was wondering whether you see anything in Christianity.
We're going to have a whole unit next week on Christianity.
Well, this relates to the root of it.
Yes, I think.
That you see anywhere in Christianity the roots of that stimulate scientific discovery.
I don't know how much you knew that.
Europe was Christian.
Yes.
Scientific discovery.
Oh,
inquiry also.
No. There's no direct connection, indirect connection. That liberal Protestantism didn't oppose scientific discovery, Catholicism not either. The connection between scientific discovery and Christianity comes in the 16th century, not in our part, when Luther for the first time recognized the existence of science. Comes in the 16th century. All great early modern scientific discoveries from any Protestant people. None. That comes in the
16th
century. But there's still an excellent question. There's nothing, I think. I think that's not a question.
There is no connection. You're telling me there is no
connection? Well, they had to take a position. The positions they took were various, but they had nothing to do with stimulating scientific discovery. What you're asking is everything is Christian, as I've made clear. But Christianity becomes secularized. So we've talked about mass movements and the war and so on, all the secularized rhythms of Christianity, all the secularized the liturgy of Christianity being secularized, yeah? Now Darwin had no Christian commitment to God. Neither did any of the others that I know of. So you have to look at it not from that point of view, but from the Christian point. No.
Well, I'm saying that what I'm trying to say is that science, there was never scientific curiosity did rise in the Muslim world.
I would be surprised if that was not false, but I'm just quite ignorant. Scientific discovery was stimulated by Luther. There's no question, but in the 60s, by the time we come, that's no longer an issue, and Lutheranism has passed through the 18th century, pietism, and therefore positive Lutheranism today, as we know, is quite different than the Lutheranism of Luther. So, but Luther did several things that were very important. For one thing, he dislocated heaven. Heaven for Luther was no longer a set place. So that, of course, made it stimulated him and so on. Luther himself was interested. But in our period, there is no connection with
there is a connection, because half of the world today is a technological society, and the other half is...
Yeah, but what has to do with Christianity is very good. Christianity is secularized. More secularized in politics than anywhere else. I don't think it's secularized in technology. So, but it's a quite unexplored area, as a matter of fact. Nobody's really studied the deep secularization of Christianity. That is an unexplored area. So I don't know whether it has to do something with Christian rhythms in our civilization. Most of that's written about Western civilization being Christian civilization is nonsense. So nobody has really written anything important about that. Getting away from the fact of church membership or traditional, or what it means, you know, in the rhythm. And I think myself, let me make that clear here, or try to, that I believe it's vastly important. But I'm only examining for politics, that they're vastly important, that mass politics is integrated into a Christian rhythm. But nobody's ever asked this question about technology. It's impossible to ask. But it's not a natural thing. It goes through a secularization process. And nobody.
Yes?
Can you talk about the conflict between materialization and making sacred?
Oh, wasn't that clear? Yes, I'm glad to do that. But there's another thing. There's always a conflict between the sacred and the trivial. Because the sacred lifts things out of the ordinary. Out of the ordinary. It is a liturgy. It connects you, if you like, to God. It induces in you higher thoughts. That's why I thought it was a very bad thing for the Catholics to make the liturgy in English. Because liturgy is something special. It's something extraordinary. It fulfills, it's a festival. The Baroque got this very right, of course. It's a festival and so on, yes? Okay. But trivialization is the opposite of a festival. It is something that you, that is so so unimportant in a sense, that you can dominate. The sacred dominates you, lifts you. But the trivial you dominate. So it is quite a conflict. And if they come together, it might disturb the sacred. I mean, I can explain it to you from church. I mean, it's obvious. There are great problems in Protestantism at first, but then also later, about all these images, as they call them, in the church. They might distract you, they are trivial, yes? You might look at the image, and the image, you might think, you look at Virgin Mary, and instead of saying what you saw, it stimulates you to have higher thoughts about Christ. And you look at it and say, you know, what a beautiful woman. That would be trivial. So there's always the conflict, and there was the conflict during the war, throughout cultural history, because people have two contradictory impulses. One is to be lifted up, and one is to be tied down, if you like, yes? And obviously, there is a difference. It comes out in the church, it comes out in the grave. Look, if you mass produce headstones for soldiers' graves, then you are integrating the sacrifice for the nation into mass production, to mass industrial society. And that immediately meant for them mass production of ugly objects, mass production of trivia. So you are really pulling down the sacred. You see what I mean? And therefore, it is an opposition to mass production and mass society, which you have in industrialism. Moreover, there's one other thing. The sacred is not, by and large, rationalized. In other words, the sacred appeals to your emotions in one way or another. I know there's a lot of reason in Protestantism, still more in Catholicism, but it appears in one way or another to your emotions. While trivia, you build in a rational way into your life. Yes? Huh? In other words, let me put it perhaps this way from another religious scene, you see? Well, I can't really think of, when you want to think of examples, you can never think of very good examples of trivia. But I think these religious examples are the best, yeah? But you can say in the battlefield, the thing I was talking about is, it trivializes the sacrifice for the nation. If you can buy a munition or a gun for 2 francs on the battlefield, if you pay 2 francs to visit a trench, because you really dominate the situation, it dominates you, yes? No. You can pay the 2 francs and you can't pay the 2 francs. It doesn't make any difference, you see? And it becomes a show. Kind of illustrated that way. As I told you, when we talked about flowers, the Germans always accused the English and French of being frivolous, not being serious people. And they thought they saw that by the military cemeteries, that the French and the English covered them with red roses and flowers, while the Germans had their wood, which is a much more serious affair than some affair. So, in that conflict, there's always the matter of frivolity. You can't be frivolous with the sacred. Zach, you're not going to go into a sacred building and start having a laughing fit. Yes? If you did that in a church or in a yeshiva, you wouldn't be thrown out of your ass. If they admitted it was. So, what you have therefore here, that clearly is that, you see what I mean? Now, as I answered you before on the Christianism, there is another unexplored element, unexplored process, and that is the whole process of trivialization. There's nothing on that at all. Yeah? And yet, I think this is one of the, as I said, one of the most important processes. Yes.
Did wartime governments make any major attempts to mobilize intellectual support? Were they successful?
Yes, of course. The anti-war movement, small, unimportant. And only important when some socialists met themselves at Timmermans in Switzerland, yeah? And with Lenin's approval, document the opposition of socialism to the war. And that's only important because it became part of the Communist Party's later, the people who were at the Timmermans conference, yeah? It's a good question to show in this sense. Yeah, sure, Marx was right that in a time of crisis, the critical mind of the intellectual collapses. If we see that we define intellectuals with a critical mind, yeah? And that especially then getting out of this cage of Marxism is a critical mind, yeah? All the people that you know, I mean, the young Lukács was enthusiastic in the war, yeah? All these people were enthusiastic. Now you could rationalize it. Remember, if you were a German socialist, you rationalize it. You say, how wonderful that we're fighting the Tsarist regime. The Tsarist regime has to fall. That's how German social democracy rationalized. The French ration, intellectuals and socialists rationalizing, we are fighting German autocracy. See? You can rationalize anything. And whoever you fight is always the dictator. So as you always stand for freedom, you are with your own country because you're fighting the dictator. That, I think, is a good rule of thumb for all these things. Yes? Yeah? For the behavior of intellectuals in any crisis, that's a very good rule of thumb, yes? You know? It's for the other people's freedom you're really concerned, not your excuse. More fun.
Speak up a little, yeah, please.
It seemed contradictory to you on Monday about France being very provincial and Germany becoming cosmopolitan,
yeah.
And yet French culture became.
No, but this was French, I'm very granted. No. The French culture they looked to was the past French culture. These liberals didn't look to the French culture of the 1920s. They looked to the past, to the Enlightenment, to the French culture of the end of the 19th century. Yeah? Not really to present French culture. In other words, in a minute I'm going to talk about the Russian Revolution and what it meant, and the Russian actors and ballet and so on coming to Germany. Yeah? Nothing like that. There were some chanteurs like Yvon Gilbert, which may still be some of your bastard chanteurs, a concept, but he was probably the greatest in our century. Yvon Gilbert and people like that, yeah? Another one. Yeah?
You say like the combination of the sacred and the civilization and war is what led to the people's acceptance.
Yeah. Yes, that was the point I was trying to make.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Building it into their lives, I think, is better than saying acceptance. Yeah? Building it into their lives. Yes.
I think that, of course, they would be the same about how liberals occupy the
social democrats occupied the space of the liberals. They were really the new liberal party.
The liberals believed in that, or did they?
No, the liberals didn't see that. That's why they stayed in such isolation. Well, in the end, they only had 4 seats in Parliament. 3 seats in the end, really. You see? They didn't see that. It's very difficult, my dear, to see what's going on contemporaneously. We don't see it either. You cannot blame these people, yes? I don't mean to blame these liberals, German liberals. But there is something very pathetic in looking to the country that has just defeated you and thinking that everybody would go along with it. Obviously, the hatred of France was much greater in Germany than any admiration. So that is a further isolating thing, but it does show how in its decline, liberalism became more and more detached from reality, that in that crisis. Now, there's one other thing I wanted to say about it, you give me the opportunity and I've sat down. Of course, things we think dead are never dead, you understand? From the point of view of the 1930s, liberalism was dead. From the point of view of the 1970s, liberalism has proved to be the strongest of all the political theories in Europe. Because after 1945 in the West, liberalism revived, and it is still dominant today. So who would have thought, in all these great lectures one used to give about the decline of liberalism, that after the Second World War, liberalism would be the dominant? Nobody would have thought that in their right mind. But it happened. It happened. And so you must say that for all this confrontation of the left and right in Germany after 1918. In the reality of history, liberalism has proved itself and has remained dominant. But what you must say, it is dominant in a time when there is no crisis. In other words, you must never forget that nowhere has parliamentary government survived the crisis. That's usually pronounced. Nowhere ever, except in the United States and England, has parliamentary government ever survived a crisis? And I would say a crisis where political, social, and economic factors came together. England and America survived the Depression because the political system and the social system was intact. That was an economic malfunctioning that was eventually corrected. But in Germany and others, similarly in France, but where economic, social, and political crises come together, parliamentary government will not survive. There's a very interesting test at this moment in the state of Israel. These three things are coming together. I know where has yet parliamentary government survived. I mean, there are good reasons. And the reasons, let me say that again, are that in such case people do not divorce politics.
They want an integrated life. They want, they are longing for integration, for a fully furnished house. And they are not willing to look at parliamentary government, which is typical for the divorce of politics and life. They want immediacy. They want to have a party. They want the false mass politics. And they don't want their some representatives doing uninteresting things. So, it's quite obvious that parliamentary government stands for the divorce of politics and life, and whenever that is endangered, it forms. I think there's no question about that. I think there's no question. We must be happy. But after all, since 1945, in Europe there have been no bad times. So liberalism obviously has flourished, and parliamentary government has flourished. When these three things come together, you may tell to me that Italy is an exception. And in a sense, perhaps that is true. But the Italians are so admirable, the most admirable people in the world, because they can do without government. You know, in Italy, there are two economies, the real economy and the economy that the government thinks is the economy. In Italy, there is a secret life which is quite apart from the government. So, the Italians are also the most civilized people, because since, I think, 1239, they have never won a war. So they're very sympathetic people in every way possible. But Italy is an example, but it's not an example, because in Italy the social fabric holds. In other words, I think for parliamentary government to connect, the three things have to coincide: social, political, and economic. But in Italy the social fabric is certainly holding. No doubt about that. Even if they try to shoot you in the leg or something. Anyhow, so, anything more? Well, you should laugh. Last time I was in Italy, I had a 24-hour police escort. I did something in Italian politics. Anyhow, never mind. But the social fabric. Anything more? Well, then let me go on from what I tried to say last time. Now, in that chaos, as you all asked, after the First World War, corporate pride left and right, we have talked about the liberals, the attempt at dictatorship of reason. I cited to you the phrase by Heinrich Mann, "Why should the beautiful preference of the mature 18th century for goodness and the recognition of human equality not be recaptured?" Well, it wasn't about to recapture. It wasn't really recaptured until after 1945. How to master the chaos and the irrational after defeat was to be answered, of course, in different ways than the liberal way. And this in spite of the fact that most people continued, and I must say that again, the Jenny Tribal kind of life. Most people's lives and reading was conventional. Most people did not go out into the street. Most people didn't like modern art any more than they like it today, which is not so. So, that popular taste has not changed. This you must now bear in mind. They're very much, very much. What we call Weimar culture is really the avant-garde. And it is the way that the avant-garde coped with the rationalism against irrationalism, with all of the things I have said, that must occupy us. Because what is innovative about Weimar, what made Germany the center, rather than France, was the avant-garde. And the way the avant-garde coped with the post-war crisis of left against right, rationalism against irrationalism, the cycle of revolution and counter a revolution. I must remind you at first where the word avant-garde comes from. Avant-garde is a military term, and all it means really, and you must bear that in mind, are those soldiers who ahead of the Alps, to reconnoiter the terrain. And that was adopted already in the 19th century by those who were cultural innovators, because it was thought, like the soldiers of the army in the old, they went and reconnoitered the terrain. Yes? Reconnoitered the terrain. This is what avant-garde means. Therefore, avant-garde, the word, has several implications, which are, I think, in the end, questionable. One implication is that the avant-garde is ahead. Now, you can make up your own mind as we talk about it, whether it's really ahead. But that is certainly the implication, that it is the way of the future. In certain things, this is correct, in others it is. The second implication is, of course, that it is an elite. Clearly, these were small troops of soldiers, what you call them in English and American warfare, spine soldiers, but not spies. Spine soldiers, but not spies, who were ahead and reconnoitered ahead. Now, both of these things, of course, bring up the problem, what about the relation of the avant-garde to the masses? And the relation, come to you in a second, the relation of the avant-garde to the masses is that in our period, in Germany, they made claims for political leadership. They were not a neutral avant-garde. In fact, there are very few of those. They were a committed and involved avant-garde. An avant-garde which thought that through culture you could bring about political change, one sort or another, radical political change, not non-political change, that through culture you could bring about what they thought of as radical political change. So then we must add to the two characterizations, really a third characterization of the modern avant-garde, intended to be politically committed. See that when we talk about architecture, well, it tended to be politically committed, more on the left than on the right, because the avant-garde, of course, continued the critical condition, a critical mind. So in a sense, the expressionists, the futurists, all those we have dealt with are avant-garde. Yes, Mr.
Yeah, well, I was thinking just the opposite. The avant-garde, if it's reconnoitering soldiers, they didn't fight.
Well, they didn't fight with weapons, but the analogy doesn't go that far. It's the soldiers who reconnoitered. So, that they were certainly committed, but you're right, because into the avant-garde goes a second tradition. I told you about the military. What that meant. That the word, but there's a second thing that goes into it, and that becomes part of the word avant-garde, or the term avant-garde. And that's something quite different. That is the Bohemian tradition of the 19th century, La Bohème, or Murger, of the 1840s, when Murger had written stories called La Bohème. And what Murger's stories are, they are really stories of lovable, unpolitical characters. Unpolitical, lovable characters who shock the bourgeoisie, but not very much. They go around in dressing gowns, and they wear slippers in the center of Paris. So on and so forth. But they don't shock the bourgeoisie very much, but still, they are an anti-bourgeois movement of sorts. Now, at the end of the 19th, they became sort of culture heroes to everybody, because by that time that tradition was shocking the bourgeoisie, expressionist who wanted to kill the father, futurist, and not merely wearing dressing gowns and slippers in the center of Paris. But on the whole, what you have is the Bohemians, the natural term, come to stand for intellect. And both of them for a kind of avant-garde. Because you must still know that I'm Bohemian, don't you? You say today a Bohemian life style. And so these two things become attached, and all of this blanket by the avant-garde. There is, I know, because of its origins in the avant-garde, a kind of presumption of a lifestyle, that intellectuals should live a certain way, that they shouldn't live in suburbs. They should live. In fact, during our student riots, that rather nice house, but luxurious, in the student riots, you know, these kids used to come to me and say, Mr. Mossy, why don't you live in a garden? If you want to be a real intellectual, you have to live on Mifflin Street. And on the other hand, I shouldn't have thought the noise on Mifflin Street would be very conducive for intellectual activity. But never mind, there is a lifestyle involved, the lifestyle of Mifflin Street, yes? You know, and it is so deep that a lot of kids, perhaps you, think that a true intellectual can only live in that student ghetto area.
Some intellectuals can get only live in the curious house.
Well, Gardner, and that's a bad example. However that might be, let me make clear the point I wanted to make, which is that it's idea of avant-garde, then, which now becomes very important, and which we have already talked about with all those who were critical of bourgeois society. There are an avant-garde, and the expressionists and futurists did want to say society through culture, if you want to put it that way, but which after 1918 becomes of crucial importance. This then has the following ingredient. The military ingredient, that is, these are groups of people who are out ahead, who are the way to the future, or reconnoitering the future, everyone. Second of all, an elite, a small group of men who are doing this. Intellectuals, obviously. And thirdly, people, I think, who want to have a political commitment. And that political commitment is anti-bourgeois, because now the tradition of critical mind, the tradition of the bohemian, you see, that's new. If you don't understand, one must always be clear to you, I knew it, that during the 18th century, the philosophers were pro-bourgeois, the philosophers were integrated in society. But I would say that Voltaire is as much an intellectual as Lukács or anyone else. That I can think of, all the expressionists. But the difference is, Voltaire as an intellectual was part of the establishment, and the others against the establishment. But that against the establishment tradition only climaxes in the Bohemian, only goes up with Bourget, but by the end of the century, it's very much a part of the history of intellectuals. It's very much a part of the idea of intellectuals. You see what I mean? It's very much a part of that. And fourthly, I would say there is the presumption of a lifestyle, a simple Spartan lifestyle. I know that the socialists by now were that way, but they were that way because they were pretty bourgeois. The intellectuals had a Spartan lifestyle on a theory, on the theory of critical bourgeois. Society means not living a bourgeois life, it means imitating the bohemians, and by the way, this is relevant to you, these bohemians were popularized through Puccini's opera of 1884, La Bohème, which I wish you would see, because it's been put on here, the opera is here very good. When is it put on, you know? In February. I won't be here, but in February, make a note of it that you be sure to see it, because it's very relevant to what you've done. Puccini's La Bohème takes Bourget's stories and makes an opera out of it. Yes? Takes Bourget's stories, opera, other things, but it's important. Now, if you say all this is the avant-garde, new cultural departure, that means also that, for example, something like the generation of 1914, which we talked about, does not qualify. Avant-garde has to have all these things. It cannot just be a youth movement. It cannot just be a movement of youth. And yet, the avant-garde changes after 1918 in one particular. It becomes more and more collective-minded. It is more and more interested after the war in collectivities rather than individuality. That is a change of the greatest importance. All the avant-garde that we have dealt with, expressionists, futurists, Vedekind, perhaps Vedekind is an exceptional source, but they're interested in, no, he's not an exception. They're interested in individuality. It's your individuality. And after 1980, whether you think of the futurist now, who became fascist, whether you think of the new architecture, the Bauhaus, whether you think of the new painting, it is all within a collective frame. There is now heightened the urge for collectivity. This is a change. And that urge of collectivity is connected, of course, to the war in spirit. For remember one thing that I told you before, that the expressionists, who used to be individualists, by the end of the war, found their way to a socialist, to a Kantian socialist. So the expressionists are a very good example of after the war you get to a kind of collectivity after the war. But it's not only the expressionists. Ernst Jünger's famous war diary, Thunder of Steel, was individual war experience. After the war, he revised it to take out any references to himself. And as you have it now, this famous war diary, Thunder of Steel, is all collective, it's all collective. We, our experience, not my experience. So you have here a very great change. Why the change? Not only the war, but the political situation. The kind of urgency and immediacy which the good bourgeois in the 1880s and 90s, why should you feel any immediacy? You go home to mother and cooking, yeah? And immediacy, what's the immediacy? There's no immediacy. So, but now there's an immediacy, yeah? Revolution, counter-revolution. You have to take position. You have to. The neutrality in such a situation is almost impossible for intellectual, possible for many other people. But it's not really possible for intellectual revolution, counter-revolution, economic misery, riots, a thousand ideas, back to that one sort or another, the countryside of Germany, popular, populated by wandering preachers. I don't want to comment if I have time for that. An interesting phenomenon, because Hitler came as one of those Buddhists, Mohammedans, people who wore only sandals, people who ate nothing but carrots all day, and Buddhists. All of those were the new prophets. Between 1918 and 1920, there was all over Europe, and especially in Germany, a tremendous resurgence of what we call life reform. Good earth, and sandals, vegetarianism, and Buddhism, all these kinds of things which go together, yes? And they all ended up, as a matter of fact, on one hill, at one place, in Ascona, in Switzerland, lots of books about that now, called the Mountain of Truth, Monte Verita. The Mountain of Truth was visited by every anarchist, every nudist, every vegetarian, every Buddhist, European Buddhist, of course, every variation of this kind of thing, which in Germany has a name, life reform. So these life reformers, political, not political, they all had their utopia, can't really go into all of this, show you the chaos. You had to take position. Everything had become unstuck. These life reformers are a sign, and Monte Verita in Ascona is a sign that everything has now become unstuck. Everything. And so there is a general chaos. And in a time of general chaos, you have these wandering creatures, Buddhists or whatever, yeah? I'm not talking to them, they may be right. That's not my concern here. But they come at every sort of crisis. They have a solution for every sort of crisis. Yes? The world will be better. It will be Paris. It will be better there. You will be better in that. And they are right in many ways. I support vegetarianism very much so, yes. They may be right. But at any rate, however it is, they are the wandering creatures. And eventually they ended up in a new cultural phenomenon, a kind of thing. Monte Verita in Ascona, in Switzerland, in the Tessin, everybody was there. Erich Mühsam, the German anarchist, the nudists, the early homosexuals, the vegetarians. They all lived on this mountain, more or less in poverty, at least in some time, in Ascona. That mountain had interesting history. You can visit it. That mountain, when all this folded by the late 1925-26, things had stabilized. And Mount Averina almost folded. Then it was bought by a very rich collector of Japanese and Chinese art, the Baron von der Heim, who transformed it into a hotel. I just made a contest last night, something that I'm professionally interested in, the 10 best hotels in Europe. The Feelings Guide, and we agree on the 10 best hotels in Europe. This is one. It certainly is worth it, because every floor to this day has Japanese and Chinese art, because he left his art collection as one of the best to the hotel. So, anyhow, however that may be, you get this extra. Monte Marita had a bad reputation at first, and then it was taken by Jung, you know. Jungians went there too, and to this day, the Jungian conference is very famous, yearly Eranos meetings, Jungian meetings, are in Ascona as well. But you can't go to Ascona anymore, it's overrun by Germans. Other Americans are a purely nasty sort of overrun other things, yes? In my age, used to be the English, and then it was the Americans, and now it's the German, and the history of tourism. Whichever nation has the money, next we are overrun by Japanese of a nasty sort. So at the moment, it's nasty, nasty sort, and if you come to the beach in Ascona, it is far from an aesthetic impression. Therefore, here it's no longer the Ascona that used to be, but in those days it was Ascona of these kind of what you would call the avant-garde. What made the avant-garde relevant? What gave them, if you like, their safety blanket, their anchor, was the Russian Revolution. Russian Revolution was a break. It was, as far as they could see, the kind of avant-garde which would fit with any one of our definitions at the time. Get that. Any kind of our definition at the time. It was not only, remember, an alternative form of government, but the Russian Revolution was from the beginning an alternative form of culture. It was an alternative form of culture which might sweep Europe. It's not only the workers' and soldiers' councils, which were important and after all imitated in the German Revolution, but just as important in that early days were the cultural manifestations, both propaganda. It's known by a name, which I have to come back to it when I talk about workers' theater. Agitation propaganda, we call it Agitprop. Agitation propaganda, the Agitprop. And also something else, namely that in the early days of the Russian Revolution, bourgeois restraints were largely abolished. One forgets that. It lasted only until about 1923. But there was new bathing. There was a freedom of the body, there was modern dance. All Russian culture seemed to be an avant-garde. And all this, of course, there was truth. This is the great age of Mayakovsky. This is the great age of Russian painting, which is only now again coming to life. It's been suppressed for all these times. Now this is the glory of the modern dance in Russia. These are the new features and all of that sort of thing. That all restraints were down. Russia seemed to fulfill it. But all the opposition to bourgeois Europe had wanted. That is to say, what Wedekind had wanted, the expressionist, the impressionist. A kind of society which was both collective and individual. A society which was free from bourgeois restraints. where sex was free and easy.
Yeah. Was the Bolshevik Revolution, or were the Bolsheviks actually very influenced by the Western European avant-garde?
Yes, very. Very. But influenced, yes, by the European. Very. But there was also together a kind of native Russian revival, which can't interest us too much. Well, we must not come from 50 to the Russian Revolution in Europe, because that's the great breaking change.
I have my doubts about these interview books, because in an interview you could never think a thought through. I mean, in the one that you read with me or with De Felice, we can never really think a thought through. Interviews are made that way. Moreover, I should tell you that the interview book that you're reading with me is an interview that was first given in Italian, and these books were first published in Italy, where, believe it or not, they became runaway bestsellers. I was just going through Sicily, and in every Sicilian village you saw my Narcismo or De Felice's Narcismo. All the peasants were reading them avidly, presumably. However that might be, I don't know how this works, and I would like to know how it works. And you at least let me know when you were threatened how you think this kind of thing works. But this is what you should read, because I'm not going to go into the length of fascism that I usually do, because I think these books are pretty much explanatory. So please.